This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A while back, we told you about a young scientist who is also a world-class diver. She was training for a mission with NASA called Project Nemo. Well, she's now an award-winning scientist.
That was an incredible honor because I've known a lot of those people for a very long time, and they've kind of ushered me through my transition from being a full-time diver to a full-time researcher.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll catch up with Dr. Dawn Kernagas and talk about the results of Project Nemo and her shiny new trophy. Also, stories on a NASA study on freshwater on Earth and continued diversity in New York State schools. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute looking for water in the Everglades. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Dawn Kernagas knows how to keep herself busy. Since 1993, she's been a diver and consultant for numerous diving exploration and research projects around the world. She was a manager with the world record-breaking deep underwater cave exploration team for over 10 years. 2 years ago, she was inducted into the Women Divers Hall of Fame. She's now a research scientist with the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition in Florida. In 2016, Dr. Kernagas was selected as one of six crew members to join NASA's 21st undersea mission. It was called Project Nemo. We first met her when she was getting ready to join that project, and we caught up with her last month to talk about both the results of Nemo and an honor she received this spring.
So I found out back in April that I had received the Young Scientist Award from the Undersea and Hyperbaric Medical Society, and so that was an incredible honor because I've known a lot of those people for a very long time, and they've kind of ushered me through my career and my transition from being a full-time diver to being a full-time researcher. So it was definitely an honor for them to recognize my career as it's been growing.
Is there any one particular project that was for, or just a body of work?
Just body of work. So they're just recognizing outstanding continuous contribution to the community.
And how long before you're no longer a young scientist?
I'm actually already past it. I think I just dipped under the wire. I was laughing that they were really scraping the barrel, I think, maybe, if they were trying to get me in there. But I think they voted about 2 weeks before I turned 41. So officially, the young scientist is defined as anyone who is 40 or younger. So I just skirted in, and then I turned 41 about 2 weeks after they voted.
And refresh our memory about exactly what that specialty involves.
So essentially, we're doing – so specifically, the work we do here at IHMC is focused on people who work undersea and finding ways to protect them against the extremes that they face. So things like breathing high-pressure oxygen, decompression sickness, otherwise known as the bends, and even things like hypothermia. So you can get cold really fast after being in the water for a long period of time. And even immersion itself can induce a lot of different effects on the physiology, but also have an impact on performance. So that's the work we do here at IHMC. In bigger picture, the undersea and hyperbaric medical society studies all of that. So looking at diving physiology, diving medicine, and even submarine medicine. And then they also move over into the realm of hyperbaric medicine, which is a huge part of what they do. So that's looking at using high pressure treatment, high pressure oxygen treatment in hyperbaric chambers for a number of different diseases and injury processes, and even decompression sickness or the bends.
And how does this come together with NASA?
So it's really interesting because you start to look at different physiological effects when you look at different extreme environments. So if you look at undersea versus space or microgravity or even hypoxia, so even being at altitude, the body tends to have a kind of unified stress response. And there's nuances to each of those, obviously, but there's a lot of overlap from space medicine and space performance into undersea medicine and undersea performance, and even looking at things like high altitude or even things like different thermal extremes.
When we spoke, it was a couple of years ago, I guess. Well, you were about to go undersea for quite some time. It was the Nemo project, right?
Correct. Yeah, that was a fantastic opportunity. That was 2 years ago now. We trained for a couple of weeks, and then we went and did the mission. The mission was a 16-day undersea mission, living at 50 feet, so the bottom of the habitat's at 60 feet. So anything we were doing outside of the habitat was at 60 feet or up to 100 feet. And so we had a crew of six people. Two of those individuals spent the entire 16 days underwater, and then the other four of us, we split up that 16 days into 2 8-day missions. So we swapped out mid-mission and had two people in for the first with the two people who were in for the entire time, and then we swapped out the other two for me and another individual. It was absolutely fantastic. It was such an incredible opportunity. So having the opportunity to live and work with astronauts and other researchers for 8 days and live in a very enclosed cramped space, but doing incredible work that we know is going to hopefully have a huge impact on future space exploration was just an awesome opportunity, a lifetime opportunity.
I'm sure you compiled a lot of data during that. Is there anything you can tell us that you learned?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of the work that we did was looking at different equipment that's been developed for trying to optimize planetary exploration. So a lot of the things that we tested out, we're looking at when you go outside of the spacecraft, for example, or when they're doing planetary exploration, how do they efficiently move through all the tasks that they have to move through. So we had things like an iPad system that was set up with tons of information for the individuals. So instead of having to constantly feed back to the science team and ask lots of questions, we were able to kind of find the information that we needed while we were running through a task. For example, looking for a specific type of coral, then how do we sample that coral and what do we do with that coral? And then how do we get all the information back to the science team? So they're interested in that for the same thing if you want to collect a geological sample, for example. So that was really interesting. So working out some of that technology that they're using for planetary exploration. And then inside the habitat, we were doing studies of the humans that were in the habitat. And so one of the things they were looking at was telomere length, for example, and we did some studies on epigenetics, which haven't been completed yet, but the telomere length study was pretty rapidly wrapped up. And they found that our telomeres actually shortened. So these are the caps at the end of our chromosomes. And as we age, those telomeres, they shorten. And so they feel like that's associated with the aging process. And so what we learned is that with the NEMO mission, there was actually shortening of the telomeres that was pretty significant, actually, compared to just had we been on Earth. We were on Earth, but back at the surface. It felt so much like a space mission, I say that. So
we're really making news here now.
So interesting enough, that reverted over time. So then they had collected samples later out to see, did that shortening sustain? Was that sustained in the telomeres? And it wasn't. So it kind of relengthened over time. So that was something interesting. It's something that's never been studied. And I think they're talking about doing some follow-up studies on that with the researcher who is running that study.
So in layman's terms, you kind of aged a little bit, but you got better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then just personally had some interesting things with vision. My vision actually improved for about 6 months, which we knew from things like people who do commercial diving and military diving in the same kind of environment, the saturation environment that we were in. And so that's been recorded in the past, but it was just really interesting to experience it firsthand and go to the eye doctor and explain why my vision improved when it's been the same for the last 10 years. It improved by about 0.5 in each eye. So that was really interesting. That's reverted back as well, by the way. So
you, of course, are a diver and have been for years. How was it? I mean, did you have to help train astronauts how to work under there?
No, not at all. So all of the astronauts that were there. First of all the astronauts go through dive training, and they do training in what's known as the Neutral Buoyancy Lab over in Houston. So when they're training for spacewalks, they go and train this giant pool that has a simulated mock-up of the International Space Station. So they actually go in spacesuits and they go through and practice every single move that they're going to be doing over the course of a spacewalk, so that it's kind of muscle memory by the time they get up into space. So all of them are scuba certified, and they've done a lot of they've done some diving, some more than others. So essentially, it was fantastic just to get into the water with people who already know how to dive, but they also have kind of an operational and team mindset. So it was just a really easy thing. And I really think that more than anything, the researchers learned a lot from them about working in a team environment and what they do operationally and what works really well for them in that setting.
I'm still trying to get over that you aged and then you got better. I mean, that must be valuable information.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And, it's a very small end, so it's not anything that's formal yet. But I think as we expand on that study, it'll be really interesting to see if that holds in a bigger population. That was 6 individuals that we studied. So, take it for what it's worth. And also you have to think part of it, we're living under sea, but our diets changed during that time. We didn't have any circadian. I mean, we still kind of had a circadian rhythm going on because we were following a typical schedule, but we weren't getting vitamin D. We weren't getting sunlight. There's these little things that we're being exposed to. So who knows what in that environment induced those changes, but it'll be really interesting to kind of tease all that out in the future.
Well, that's the past. What's next? What's coming up? Where are you going to take your award and go now?
Well, here at IHMC, I'm staying here. So we're really excited. We've got this incredible team that's built up since last time you and I spoke. And so we've got experts in space medicine and aerospace medicine and performance and even just overall kind of strength and conditioning and physical performance. And we've got an incredible team that's kind of working with us in that area to develop a number of different projects. We have a project funded by NASA right now where we're looking at brain lymphatic response to simulated microgravity. So we're just learning that the brain actually has a lymphatic system. And so we think that that might be impacted when you have a fluid shift towards the head, like astronauts do in space. And so we want to see how that's impacted and can we reverse that if we need to. We've got studies looking at different nutritional fuels for protecting people, especially warfighters, so especially military operators in different extreme environments. So things like cold water, for example, or hypoxia, so low levels of oxygen. Can we use certain nutritional fuels for protecting them against those extremes that they're being exposed to? So we've got funding from a number of different DOD organizations to support that work.
Sometimes I think people around here need to be reminded just what goes on in this campus. It's amazing.
It's incredible. Every time you turn the corner, you've got, you know, a world expert in robotics or AI, and just it's a fantastic place to be with just this wealth of knowledge and experience. And also the cool thing about IHMC is that it is a flat organization, so we all integrate with each other, and it just makes the work that much more efficient and that much more fun, too.
I mean, are you working on any machines to go up there, take up to space?
So we aren't directly in our research group on the human performance side of things, but we do have Peter Newhouse, who's working on an exercise device that would potentially be going into space, and he's working in conjunction with Johnson Space Center on kind of developing that and seeing if that would be something feasible for future space operations.
Guess that makes sense. A lot of muscle atrophy in low gravity, right?
Yeah. Exercise is incredibly important for astronauts for maintaining bone health and muscle health and just overall health up in space.
Dr. Don Kernagis is a research scientist with the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition in Pensacola, Florida. So while we're talking about NASA and also water, a new study from the space agency is showing that fresh water around this planet is being redistributed, and that could lead to food insecurity and climate refugees. From H2O Radio, executive producer Jamie Sudler reports.
Fresh water around the world is constantly moving, but maybe not in a way that suits current human habitation. Dry areas on the planet are getting drier, and wet areas are getting wetter. That's the conclusion of recent NASA-led research. It's been known that fresh water from glaciers or aquifers is running out, like in high-altitude glaciers in the Himalayas or from groundwater in central California. However, this study, published May 17th in the journal Nature, shows that water worldwide is being redistributed, and the implications are quite serious. Data collected by two NASA satellites over 14 years shows that regions in the high latitudes of the globe and regions in the tropical bands are getting more water, and regions in between are becoming more arid. The scientists analyzed 34 hotspots looking for either too little or too much water and the rate of change. Among those was the Ogallala Aquifer in the heartland of the U.S., which is being overused for agriculture. And overpumping for growing food is a global problem. Water loss is occurring in areas as diverse as Saudi Arabia and China. The scientists attributed the problem to various factors like the possibility of climate change, human activities such as pumping groundwater, or the frequency of extreme flooding and drought. One of the study's authors, senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, is Jay Famiglietti. He said what's new about this study is that the data they analyzed was collected by NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment satellites, also known as the GRACE mission. The satellites weigh water mass changes rather than using images of Earth's surface.
Well, first of all, we looked at the whole, all of the continents. So in past studies, we've either picked out individual spots and written a paper on one location in detail.
Looking at the map of where fresh water is being redistributed, Famiglietti is very concerned about the study's implications.
I guess I think there's huge implications for food and food security because many of the aquifers are being depleted, and they are the primary source for irrigation water. I think that there are many issues with human security, meaning access to fresh water is changing because we're developing classes of haves and have-nots.
What's being defined as a geography of water increases and decreases, which will lead to climate refugees. For example, some will flee regions becoming more prone to flooding, and others will leave dry places once fed by glaciers. The problem requires solutions that cut across political boundaries. For instance, with groundwater, Famiglietti says depletion has to be managed across state and country lines. The Colorado River Basin is a great example, he says, of people not talking about groundwater among states, much less with Mexico. But it's the urgency of the situation that demands attention.
We are able now to see the pace of change and to see the scope of the problem. And this is a problem that requires action regionally, nationally, and internationally. So in my opinion, there are no excuses for inaction.
According to Famiglietti, the study shows water security is far more tenuous than we have recognized. From Denver for H2O Radio, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Still to come, New York State is taking action after the feds attack affirmative action. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. After the Trump administration said the federal government will let schools leave race out of admissions decisions, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo directed the state's university system to continue policies that promote racial diversity among students. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
In a letter stating the new federal action should have no bearing on admission policies and should not interfere with SUNY's and CUNY's commitment to a diverse and inclusive student body, Cuomo gives the chairman of the boards of trustees of the City University of New York and State University of New York an August 15 deadline to compile a report on how they'll increase diversity on campuses. The Democrats said the SUNY system has long embraced diversity and encouraged social mobility. He noted that nearly half of SUNY students are minorities and called the White House's action a blatant attempt to limit the participation of minorities in higher education. University at Albany spokesperson Jordan Carlio Evangelist says 42% of the incoming freshman class hails from groups historically underrepresented in higher education.
That's something that we're enormously proud of, our record of attracting and retaining and graduating students from those communities. And you know, other folks have taken notice of that, too. In years past, the Education Trust has identified UAlbany as a top performer nationally for both African-American and Latino-Latina student success. So, you know, not only are we adept at sort of attracting students from these groups to attend our university, but they get here, they stay here, and they succeed. And we're really tremendously proud of that. And, you know, for all those reasons are why we stand really strongly with the governor and SUNY in their commitment to fostering this inclusive learning environment, which we know from experience is absolutely critical to academic and research excellence.
Not everyone agrees. The Washington-based National Center for Public Policy Research is siding with Trump. Project 21 Black Leadership Network member Dr. Carol Swain is a former professor at Vanderbilt and Princeton.
As a black woman, I've always felt that acceptance to higher education should be merit-based and means-tested. I believe President Trump is wise to rescind the aggressive Obama-era affirmative action directive for the use of race and ethnicity in student admissions. These are affecting colleges and universities as well as K-12 education. The Obama directive, while well-intended, resulted in blatant discrimination against Asians and non-protected races and ethnicities.
Swain argues current policy is more of a detriment to minority students' success than a helping hand in navigating the education system. Project 21 recently released its Blueprint for a Better Deal for Black America, recommending schools be required to meet minimum graduation rate standards for both general and minority student populations to be eligible for federal student financial aid, among other ideas. Meantime, University at Buffalo College Access expert Nathan Dawn Barnett tells Spectrum News there have been about a half dozen Supreme Court challenges connected to affirmative action over the last two decades, and he believes colleges and universities have already shaped their practices based on those decisions.
I don't think the challenges will come until the Supreme Court is filled again. You know, Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, likely would have been in this case as well. So they'll wait to see what happens with this ninth appointment.
Carlio Evangelist says UAlbany's diversity inclusion is one of the five priorities in its recently completed strategic plan.
And that plan is going to guide our efforts over the next 5 years as we try to celebrate these individual differences that make our student body so diverse, but at the same time sort of promote constructive dialogue about those differences and the exchange of ideas. And, you know, if we do that right, and we sure intend to, that will impact not just our campus, but the community beyond our campus. And we're really proud of the success that UAlbany has had to date in attracting and retaining and graduating a really diverse student body from across the spectrum.
Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
We spent a lot of time talking about water today, so let's not stop now. The Everglades need a lot more H2O, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Fight fire with fire and water with water? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Renee Price, professor of Earth and Environment at Florida International University, explores how to stop saltwater intrusion in the Everglades with more water.
The Florida Everglades needs more fresh water to fight sea level rise. That's because more parts of the Everglades are susceptible to saltwater intrusion. My colleagues and I found sea levels rose 2.2 centimeters every year from 2011 to 2015. Something that surprised us as researchers was a notable increase of 10 centimeters in the dry season months when sea level is typically at its lowest. The result is that areas that were once flooded by seawater 70% of the year are now flooded by seawater 90% of the year. Many factors caused the drastic increases in sea level. Melting ice sheets, a strong La Nina season, and slow ocean currents allowed seawater to pile up along South Florida's coastlines. There are things we can do to save fresh water in the Everglades. In 2000, Congress created the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan to bring back water flow to the tropical wetland. It recommends resource managers release more fresh water into the Everglades. Most of that is added during the wet season. This helps fight saltwater intrusion when sea levels are highest. But saltwater can still move inland in the dry season when fresh water isn't being released. The original Everglades Restoration Plan did not take sea level rise into consideration. But to combat sea level rise in the Everglades, we need to fight water with water. Even a small amount of fresh water released at the right time of year can make a big difference, and fresh water levels in the Everglades need to be maintained higher than sea level. Because of this, we recommend resource managers deliver additional fresh water to the Everglades throughout the entire year, not just in the wet season.
That was Renee Price of Florida International University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.